Thank you very much for that introduction. The subject that we're due to discuss today is a particularly difficult issue in Jewish philosophy, religious philosophy, and that's the question of the problem of the interaction of free will with destiny, or with another person's destiny, for want of a better word. Let me try to explain what the question is, or the problem is, and then try to perhaps flesh it out or fill it in. Okay. The question is like this. The general issue of free will and how it works is a basic subject. I don't want to deal with that today. I'd like to deal with the specific difficulty of assuming that I do have free will, which of course all spiritual thinking is based on that axiom. The question is, how can I genuinely affect you? The problem is like this. If you have a spiritual accounting, that means you believe, we should believe, you should believe, you should understand, that you get in life what is due to you in many ways, either because of Rosh Hashanah, there's a judgment that is issued, as it were, Gzeirah, a decree governing what will happen to you during the year or from moment to moment at a certain level. There is a dispensation that's given to you according to what you need. How can someone else affect you by their free will? I don't see any enlightened faces. Hey, let's make it a bit more dramatic. Somebody walks out in the morning and they have a spiritual dispensation, let's say, that they have 25 years of life left to live. That means, if you could see it from the spiritual world, if you could see the divine point of view, let's assume, this person is not going to die today. That means there's no reason that they should die in terms of their own spiritual situation. Or to put it more bluntly, if you ask Hashem, if you ask God, He would say, this person, I have no problem with him, he's got 25 more years to live, he's going to raise a family, he's going to do certain things in life, have certain opportunities. That's my perspective. So that person steps out into the street, and his dispensation, his spiritual destiny, I don't know what word you use in English, but his spiritual situation is that he need not die today. He's not going to die today. I'm not talking about God's foreknowledge. That's a completely different issue. That's completely off limits in this discussion. Of course, he knows exactly what will happen and what will be modified. We're not talking about that. We're talking about what's called decree. That means there's a similar to, you know, when a prophet comes along and makes an announcement that there will be a certain eventuality. Now, the prophet says, for example, that thus and thus will happen. So that's not inevitable. That's not inevitable. For example, what's written is that it's a negative prophecy, it can be changed. The point of a negative prophecy is to get you to modify your behavior and change the consequence. If it's a positive prophecy that affects the Jewish people, cannot be changed. We're not talking about divine foreknowledge here. We're talking about a manifest decree. Let's call it that. So if there's a decree at a particular level, and the decree on this individual, so to speak, is that there's no reason that they should die. They have more years to live. And they walk down the street, and some terrorist or some assassin tries to kill them. Do you see the problem of free will that we're setting up now? Anyone out there? The problem is like this. If the individual, the would-be assassin, has free will, if he has genuine free will, then he can kill this individual. But how can he kill somebody who wasn't, as it were, destined to die today? That means, how could he affect the destiny? How could he affect the situation of someone who, if not for this act of free will, of aggression against him, really had no reason to die today? And this is a very difficult problem. If you say that the person has genuine free will, how can he kill someone? How can you come to harm at the hands of someone who wants to harm you if you don't really need or deserve that harm? And if you tell me it's not possible, then you're really depriving of any agent of free will. If you say that you're only going to get today what's coming to you, then there's no way that that person's free will can affect you. Put it more sharply, if someone kills someone else, the attitude we'll have to take is he was going to die at that moment anyway. Why will you take this individual to court? Why will they be put on trial in a based in a court of law? Because they chose to be the agent, but it would have happened anyway. Do you see the problem here? Yeah, don't be so English. Nod, you know, just... Let me try and express it a bit more plainly. What are the two sides? Two sides are like this. Either you say that I have genuine free will, that means I can affect you genuinely. And your dispensation is irrelevant. That means you are a victim. You could be a genuine victim of my free will. Of course, I could help you too. And give you a charitable assistance or help you in some way that would not have happened otherwise. And I'm the cause. And if I harm you, I'm the genuine cause. And you can look to me as being the genuine cause of your good or bad. The problem with that is that the upside, if you like, of that is it grants me, that notion gives me full free will. That means I have a genuine effect in the world. I'm a real cause. The problem is, how can I affect you if you don't deserve it? The victim is in a problematic situation here. Alternatively, you can say, the victim only gets what's coming to them. The agent only chose to be the agent, but it would have been something else. Had it not been for me, it would have been someone else. A virus, a bus would have come around the corner, a brick would have fallen off the roof. Something else would have killed them at that moment. That is very good from the point of view of the victim, because it means that you never get what you don't deserve, but it's very problematic from the point of view of the acting agent, because it means I never affect a cause in the world. I cannot help you. I can't even engage in a meaningful love relationship with you. There's nothing I can do for you. That wasn't going to happen anyway. If I hadn't said this kind word to you or benefited you in this way, it would have happened some other way. And if this person had not killed that individual, he would have died that moment anyway. First of all, we don't relate to the world intuitively like that. We certainly relate intuitively to the world as if the cause is the genuine cause. And secondly, it makes justice a very seemingly superficial notion. That means when a person's on trial for having damaged your property, the real nature of the trial is he's on trial only for choosing to be that agent. But he's not on trial for having caused the damage. We pretend that he was the cause of the damage for purposes of the trial. But he's really not the cause. He would have had it coming anyway. Do you see the dilemma? If you're driving around, you say, I'm having enough trouble with me right now. Just hold the questions, okay? Let me try to illustrate the subject, delineate it clearly, and I'll stop for questions with pleasure if I'm still vertical by then. When you drive out of here this afternoon and someone dents your car, right? And you get out and you say to them, and you still make a whole, of course you would never make an angry speech, but you know, you're mistaken because you had it coming anyway. You had it coming. What do you want from him? He chose to be the agent. He was negligent. So you can charge him for it financially. You can have a case against him. But he wasn't really the cause. Can you feel that that's a very uncomfortable? On the other hand, you can say that he genuinely was the cause. But then how did you get damage that you didn't deserve? I hope the problem is plain. Okay. Let's take a little voyage to some of the issues that I think are background issues here that I hope illustrate the issue in a hopefully a bit more of a dramatic fashion and see where it takes us. There's a source in the halakhic literature known as the Pisrei Tshuva, deals with an issue that's related. Let's try and work it through. This is a complicated discussion. Do you have the energy? Yeah. Now you must be the black belts if you... Let's see if we can follow it through. Let me set the scene and see if we can attack it in layers. Here's the scenario. He writes that he received the following question. You know, the personalities and the exact specifics, not necessarily relevant here. But let me give you the general picture. There was at that time, you're talking a couple hundred years ago, there was one of the halakhic geniuses of that generation. Talking about a master of Torah, person who led the generation, one of the great rabbinic figures, happened to be attending a fair, I think it was in Leipzig, a commercial expo. Now, the way financial disputes were settled in that context was that they used to make a basin. Even the non-Jews used to submit themselves to that process. And then you know the way it is. A basin is constituted of three competent individuals. One of the methods of selecting a basin is that each litigant selects one judge. Yes, two of them. And then the two of them select a third. And that constitutes a basin. We always have an odd number. Never an even number in a basin. Why? So you can never have a hung decision. Always an odd number. And these three sit and adjudicate the case. Now, two Jews had a financial case, a problem. And so they constituted a based in a Jewish court of law in order to adjudicate the case. On this based in turned out to be two individuals. And the third was this great halakhic authority. And he writes that the following scenario developed. The case began to be heard. Evidence was led. And he realized, this great, Torah sage, he realized that the other two judges in the case were colluding dishonestly against the innocent party. Okay, let's get it clear. He finds himself adjudicating a case, he's a judge on a case, and he realizes that the two other judges are dishonest. and they're about to take money from an innocent party and hand it to a completely illicit judgment. So he has the following dilemma. What can he do about this? If he votes for the truth, then he will be outvoted by the other two, and the case will be lost, and injustice will be perpetrated. In fact, in Jewish law, the dissenting judge is not even allowed to disclose that he dissented. You know that? The decision comes down as a unanimous act of the Beis Din. Yes? If three of us sit in the Beis Din, and we vote against you, but I was on your side, I'm forbidden afterwards to approach you and say, you know, I really was on your side, but they outvoted me. I'm not allowed to do that. So there would have been a unanimous decision against innocent party, and a miscarriage of justice would have occurred. So, but he had an option. One option he had to avoid the situation was to say, I don't know. Because if a judge says, I don't know, if a dayan on a Beis Din says, I don't know, the case is hung. Case is dissolved. In fact, what we do is we add another number of judges. Yes, we substitute or add, maintaining an odd number as well. We'll go to 5 or 7, and we'll rehear the case. But you'll prevent an immediate miscarriage of justice. So his option was, he could say, I don't know. The problem was that to say that, he'd have to lie. Because he didn't know. Do you hear the problem? This was his moral dilemma. Do I vote for the truth? Yes, do I state the truth in the situation and have a falsehood result? Or do I say a falsehood to have truth result? Yes, not a simple moral dilemma. See, he sat there and thought about wondering what was the correct line of action here. And then he thought of a halakhic precedent. Now, of course, you have to be very great, you have to be very knowledgeable to think of this precedent. Although, no doubt, some of you in the audience have already raced through all of Talmudic writing and literature. You've already identified the precedent. But in case the one or two of you haven't correctly identified the precedent, I'll tell you what it is. He said he thought of the following case. The Rambam says, in fact, it's brought in the Talmud, the Rambam writes about it, what happens if a person's on trial for his life? And the voting takes the following form. First of all, let's set the scene. You know, in a capital case in Jewish law, you need more than 3 judges. You need 23 or 71, whatever it is, you need a great Sanhedrin. We cannot do that today. We don't have the requisite qualifications. We don't have the what it takes. But imagine yourself in a generation where a capital case is being heard. The Sanhedrin sits in a semicircle so they can all see each other. And all the evidence is led and all the 7 levels of cross-examination. It's a detailed procedure. And finally, the vote begins. Now, the procedure was they used to vote from junior to senior. The most junior member, right? You're all sitting here on the Sanhedrin, all great halachic authorities, leaders of your generation. And let's say on this end, with your apologies, here you have the most junior members of the Sanhedrin, still superbly competent and qualified, and they start voting, right? Whether the man should die or live. Yeah, convict or acquit. Vote, and the vote goes round. Why do we start with the most junior? So we don't have any junior influenced by a prior senior vote. Do you belong in yeshiva? So we vote from junior to senior. And the last member to speak, which is what's called the Mufla Sanhedrin, the great halachic genius of his generation, as you can see, he has the final vote. And he is... Yeah, that's it. Now, the vote in order to convict someone for a capital offense, in other words, to have him put to death, must be obviously a majority vote. Yes? But there's one type of majority that's invalid. You're exempt. One type of majority vote that is invalid. That means, let's say, yes, there's a majority against a minority that says convict. Death sentence is carried out. But there's one type, there's one particular number in the majority that's not valid. Know what that is?
A difference by one.
No.
A unanimous vote to convict. Then he's acquitted. Let's look at this clear. Assume the vote goes like this. Guilty, 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 guilty. And there are a few individuals who say he's innocent. But there's a preponderance to convict him. The person's killed. Person on trial. But if they all say guilty, every single dayan, including the last one, he's acquitted. Now, what's the reason? This is not our subject directly, but I'll just mention the reason. The reason is, it's an interesting discussion, and but I'll share with you one reason at least that's mentioned in some of our sources, is this. If nobody could find a reason to acquit him, if nobody could find a reason, we are suspicious that perhaps they didn't examine the case closely enough. That means if nobody could find an exemption, right? If nobody could find some room for doubt, some benefit of the doubt that might be given, There's a possibility they examined the case too superficially. That's not good enough and we acquit. Just one sec, hold on a sec. That's the law. Now, imagine the following scenario. Now, listen carefully how it goes. Imagine a person's on trial for his life and the whole case is heard and the voting begins. And it goes guilty, 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 kill him, death, death, kill, kill. Until finally there's one vote left. And the greatest among us is about to give his vote. And he knows the man's guilty. See the dilemma? So if he says what he believes and he votes to convict him, scot-free, walks out a free man, this murderer. But if he changes his vote and he says innocent, which is dishonest, the man will be convicted and killed, which is as it should be. Do you see the parallel? Should he say that which is wrong for the truth, vote to acquit him and have him killed, which is what he knows the man deserves, or should he say what he feels and a miscarriage of justice in his eyes will take place? You see the parallel?
He should think.
So
he should think differently. He should say, well, we didn't analyze the case, and if one said,
well,
I still think you're guilty, we didn't analyze the case
anyway. That's too clever for me. Too deep for me. No doubt you're right. But the ruling of the Rambam is, in this case, he has to say what he believes. Because that's a judge's job, that's his task. He has to say, if guilty, he says guilty. The fact that the person walks out is not his problem. Whose problem is it? And we have to study this in depth. But we'll come back to it, hopefully a little bit later. But that is the ruling. And he said, when he remembered this precedent that the Rambam brings down, that if the last man to speak has to cast his vote, he has to say honestly what his judgment is, whatever happens to the case happens, even if it appears to be contrary to what he felt should happen in the case, that's his obligation. When he remembered that, he said he knew how to conduct himself in the case that faced him, namely the issue of these two judges who were against him. In fact, it's a bit more complicated. I don't want to get into the details. The sources say, again, the Pesach Tshuva says, and it's discussed, if you feel the other two judges are wrong, yes, not dishonest, not incompetent, just wrong, you very strongly feel they're wrong, your job is to say what's right. Okay? You're outvoted, that's the nature of a Beis Din. If, however, they are dishonest, this is not called a Beis Din, then you should take the line of saying, I don't know, dissolve the issue, dissolve the court, and have a retrial. But this is one issue of background. Let's take the next step, having set the scene with that example, and see if we can work through the issue. Let's speak out the two sides again and see how they work. The truth is, whichever side you take in this debate, probably you have good source, because almost certainly this is an argument among our early authorities, goes back very far, this argument. There certainly are those who come down on either side of it, and I'd like to try to convince you that one side is perhaps the preferable one to take, but we needn't be stubborn about it because both these approaches have been developed. The two sides again are this. My free will can never affect you. It's only my choice. I choose only to be the agent. I make a choice in the world, but I never have an effect. And therefore, you never get what you don't deserve. That's the one side. And in fact, if you want a source for this, the Munus Vadeus says this. Satya Ghan says it. He says that the way he puts it very beautifully, he says you're guilty for the murder, but not for the killing. You're guilty of what he calls the retzach. When someone kills someone else, they're guilty of the murder, but not the death. The man would have died anyway. The victim would have died anyway. That you cannot change in the world. You can't affect someone else in that fashion. Okay, this is a classic source for this opinion. But there are other sources which take the other point of view, and I'd like to speak them out. So far, are we together? It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. Okay. The other side is like this. That when you act, you have a genuine effect. And the problem we have to resolve is, how can a person be a victim of someone else's free choice, even if you, so to speak, are not deserving? Let's try and work this out. First of all, what's the classic source? Without question, the most classic source in our literature is a famous Or HaChaim. But there are others who say this. The Malbim, the Al-Sheikh also says this. And there are many other sources that take this line. The source is as follows. You know in fact, this is what we're about to read in the Torah this time of year. You know when the brothers sold Joseph, there was a fascinating incident that occurred that brings out this point very, very clearly. You know, they judged his case, and they judged him as being liable to the death sentence, right? Well, how they did that, and how brothers could form a court that judges a relative, all these are issues. But the fact is that they had a tribunal, they judged that his case was a capital case, and it needed to be put to death. But they were about to execute a death sentence, and like we always find in Torah in Torah, one, the death sentence that should have been carried out was going to be one of the four methods of execution that the Torah stipulates. As they were about to execute Joseph, Yosef, one of the brothers, Reuben, said to them, "Lo nakenu nafesh, let's not kill him. Right? Let's not kill him. Let us throw him into one of these pits that was there in the desert." In fact, the way it actually transpired was, he said, it's worth looking up yourself because the verses are, the way it's learnt out from the words in the psukim, in the verses with exquisite precision, worth looking up the details yourself. But the expression is like this. The Torah said, they said to each other, "Let's kill him and see what happens to his dreams." You remember Joseph had dreams that ultimately the brothers and his family will one day bow down to him. So they said, "Let's kill him and see what happens to his dreams. Let's see what happens to his dreams." Now, you know, the wrong way to translate that is in a sort of a childish, vindictive sense. Let's kill him and see what happens to his dreams. You know, his dreams will be proved to be false. The deep meaning is this. Let us put him to death and see what happens to his dreams. In other words, he had dreams that a certain event would occur in the future. We would bow down to him. Is he right? Is he wrong? We feel he's wrong. Can we be absolutely sure? Is any judgment absolutely sure? Not necessarily. But let's carry out our judgment and kill him. And then we'll see that his dreams will not take place. Then we'll know that we were vindicated. Are we together? Again, if his dream is that we'll bow down to him in the future and we kill him, then immediately it will be apparent that we'll never bow down to him in the future. He's dead. So we'll immediately know that our case was just. And his dreams were wrong. And it was all a false, yes, a false issue, and that will make it clear. That was their plan. So Reuben said to them, "Don't kill him. Let's throw him into one of the pits." And in fact, they decided not. It says that Reuben saved him from their hand. In fact, the words of the Or HaChaim are that he saved him from the hand of free will. Miyad HaBechira, he says. Or Yad HaBechiri. He saved him from the hand of free will. It means like this. They decided to throw him into one of the pits. And the verse in the Torah says, "V'aboy reik ein boy mayim." The pit was empty. It contained no water. What's problematic about that statement?
Nothing in it.
It's redundant, right? If it's empty, there's nothing in it. So why does the Torah say it was empty, there was no water in it? So the Gemara says in at least two places, it was empty of water, but full of snakes and scorpions. Lethally dangerous snakes and scorpions. Right? Now the obvious question is this. Don't kill him, just throw him into a pit full of snakes and scorpions. You know, what is that if not putting him to death? But that's what they did. And of course, you know, he survived in the pit. What was going on, explains Or HaChaim, is like this. Reuben said to them, now stay carefully with me because this is the classic source. He said, "Look, if you put him to death and then you turn around and say that you vindicated, your judgment was correct, because the fact that he died then shows that his dreams could never come true, so you're correct, you're wrong about that. Because human free will is so powerful, you could put to death somebody who does not deserve to be put to death. And then don't turn around and say, oh, we were correct, because look, his dreams turned out to be false. His dreams might have been correct, and you can change destiny. You could change the prophetic dreams, and you could kill somebody who does not deserve to be killed. Why? Because human free will is so important that the whole cosmic structure is reconfigured, yes, from moment to moment, to allow the reality of human free will." And they accepted that, and they threw him into the pit. Why? Because snakes and scorpions are not human agents. Snakes and scorpions have no free will. And no snake or scorpion could ever kill anyone who does not spiritually, yes, have that dispensation. If you don't deserve to die, no self-respecting snake or scorpion could possibly touch you. Why? Because you better believe, absolutely. No, nothing in the creation ever does what it's not supposed to do except you and me and a few others. That means the only points of freedom in the whole creation are the source himself, Hashem himself, and human beings. No snake, no scorpion, no cockroach, no atom, no molecule, no planet, nothing ever does what it's not supposed to do. No free will, only human beings. And therefore, throw him into a situation of certain death, but not at human hand, and we're not going to get into the complications here of what's called a grama. That means when you put a person into a situation of certain death when you're not the proximate cause, how liable are you? That's a fascinating issue that needs to be examined. But we have enough complications today. That is what they decided to do, and that was a calculation. So let's get the calculation clear again. They were worried, Reuben pointed out to them, that you need to be concerned that you could kill somebody who does not deserve to die. You'll have no proof if he dies that he was meant to die, because you could kill someone who does not deserve it and change his destiny. That's how real human free will is. So far, so good? Okay, that's a classic source on that side. Let's think it through a bit more carefully and try and feel it out together, and we'll stop for questions afterwards. But let's just try and feel out the implications. First of all, this works. There are modifications. Let's try and take it apart. You can only affect someone else genuinely to the extent that they are vulnerable. Again, this does not mean, we are not saying today that anyone's free will is so real that you can do anything to anybody under any circumstances. We're not saying that. All we're saying is there's a possibility of doing something to someone that they didn't ordinarily deserve. That's possible. Under most real circumstances in life, it does not happen. Okay? And try and explain why. And the reason is this. You can only affect someone in a way that their destiny, their dispensation, their spiritual accounting, whatever you wish to call it, does not deserve, to the extent that they are vulnerable spiritually. And the way you're vulnerable spiritually is by lacking what we call schus, you lack merit. In other words, to the extent that you have spiritual merit, you are defended and protected against someone applying his free will against you. To the extent that you are vulnerable because you've not built yourself spiritually, to that extent you could be harmed. To the extent that you merit it, you cannot be harmed. And let's take an extreme example. Somebody who has absolutely clear and clean slate spiritually. Someone has no spiritual vulnerability. Technically what we call in Torah, a tzaddik gamur. That means a completely impervious, completely righteous individual. Such an individual, if you could picture such an individual, is completely immune. Person tries to shoot him, the gun will jam. Yeah, something will happen, but he could not, unless he was meant to die at that moment, no one could touch him. Right? Example, a possible example, each of them has complications, but a possible example would be Mordechai. Mordechai decided to face up to Haman in a way, yes, asserting his invulnerability. You know what he did? Haman ordered all Jews to bow down to him, everyone to bow down. Mordechai refused to bow down, but not only refused to bow down, he deliberately sat where he knew Haman would see him and refused to bow down to him. Why? Because his plan was to drive this individual insane with anti-Semitic hatred, to the point that he would destroy himself, which is, of course, what happened in the end, right? You can only do that, you dare only do that, if you are immune, invulnerable. That means you have to be so spiritually pure that someone else's free will cannot touch you, right? That's what he decided to do. That's called tzaddik gamur, completely impervious. That is a very dangerous game to play, because you have to be perfect, and because the general default position in the world is that the evil forces have the upper hand. Right, in case you hadn't noticed. The evil forces have the upper hand. It's based on a verse, Eretz Nitna Beyad Rosha. The world is given over into the hands of the evil people until the messianic advent, when things will be corrected and things will be clear and transparent, and things will be understood. But until then, the dark forces, the evil forces have the upper hand, and therefore the role now has to be, in a sense, apologetic. In a sense, it has to be a ducking and dodging, a diplomatic approach. You have to know where force is appropriate and where force is not appropriate, but a direct, full frontal, forceful attack is often not the appropriate response, and it's because we do not have the upper hand. There were times in Jewish history when we did, and there are times when the forces of good will have the upper hand again. But if you're completely impervious, you could stand up to such a thing. But to the extent that you're vulnerable, you dare not stand up against a real free will of an individual. Okay? How do you approach the situation? Obviously, none of us are absolutely perfect, impervious, spiritually perfect individuals. But what you need to do is develop as much schus as possible, right? As much merit. It may not be yours, it may be your wife's. It could be that a person who becomes the victim of some aggression may not have enough merit, but maybe his wife doesn't deserve to be a widow. Maybe she has enough merit. Do you understand? Maybe his children, maybe his family. In fact, there are Jews who follow this line of thinking very extremely and very practically. I'll give an example. There are those who take out no insurance. Why? Well, think about it. Let's say I'm walking down the road. I have a $10 million insurance policy. Someone turns the corner and tries to, yes, end my life. Well, Hashem looks down and he says, well, Tats, let's think about this. $10 million insurance policy, your wife's taken care of. Not good. Not good. But if I have no insurance policy, you see, and my family need me, then it's a more complicated reconfiguring of the computer, and he's got a lot more bother, as it were, and set up a lot. He may put up with me a little longer than he might have otherwise. And it's a very good policy, Jewishly, to make yourself as indispensable to as many people as possible, genuinely, with genuine goodness. There's other good reasons for that conduct too, believe me. But this is good enough. Okay, a very good ulterior motive for making yourself indispensable. That means get yourself into the whole system, the whole spiritual system, so indispensably that the thing can't move without you. So many people need you. You may be protected, yes, because the extended merit may be adequate to save you in these circumstances. But that would be an example. And therefore, that is one modification of the system. It goes according to your merit. And there are many others. I don't want to go into them in detail. I'll just mention one. A human being's free will can attack someone else only under certain circumstances. One, that they lack the merit to defend themselves. Two, only against an individual, not against a group. When a terrorist gets onto a bus with a bomb, and a group of victims are damaged, this does not apply at all. There's a clear Jewish line of approach to that is that each victim there had his own spiritual accounting, right? So we're not talking about being punished, we're not talking about that, but there's a spiritual dispensation accounting that each one has to know is his own, and it has nothing to do with the free will of the aggressor. Of course the aggressor is guilty. Of course he's fully liable to the full extent of the law, no question about that. But he never affected the destiny of any individual. And thirdly, the aggressor has to be somebody who's worthy of having free will. We're talking about the brothers and Joseph. We're not talking about nobodies. We're talking about people of spiritual content, spiritual greatness. To that extent, you can expect and claim to have a real effect in the world. But if you never built yourself into a spiritual agent, you yourself are only a victim of statistics and chance, and you believe that your life goes that way. You think you have any effect on anyone else, you certainly don't. And there are many other modifications. Incidentally, I'll mention one other. Somebody with great political power has no free will at all. You know that? A king, for example, or a prime minister. Somebody of major political power has no free will to affect his people at all. It says in the verse, Lev Melachim Vesarim Beyad Hashem, that the heart of kings and princes is in Hashem's hands. Which means that, and the irony is that when a person reaches that pinnacle of political power, is when he thinks he's got real free will and real power. And at that moment he becomes a complete puppet in the divine hand. Of course he's accountable for his actions. And of course he's morally accountable. And of course he's accountable in his own personal life. But he cannot make one move that affects the people in general, because that's a divine manifestation. War is also like that. In war, there's also a direct divine, right? Balaam el-Chomo is Hashem is the one who makes wars himself, and wars are a completely illogical thing very often. It also needs examination. But there are many limitations to this principle. So far, so good? Many times more than anyone else we've mentioned today. Now, doesn't mean he's not responsible, right? But it means there's no effect that's manifest on us. That's not where we look. We look that way, not east or west, yeah, that way. Let me share with you a wonderful insight into this. Can we go a little bit deeper? Yes, are the two opinions clear here? Let's go a little bit deeper, and let me share with you a wonderful insight into this in the classic source and try and resolve it for you, and I'll stop in case you have any questions. This will take a little concentration, okay? Never saw such an enthusiastic crowd. That's good, yes. There is a classic source known as the Chinuch. The Chinuch is a wonderful source, many centuries old already, which goes through the mitzvahs. Classic work on the 613 mitzvot, and he goes through each mitzvah and he gives us halachic parameters and he gives you a lot of information about the mitzvah. One of the humiliating things about the Chinuch is it was written by one of the great halachic Torah minds of those many centuries ago. We don't know who. It was written anonymously. What's a little humiliating for us is that it is a work of major content for us. He wrote it for his 12-year-old son. Mm-hmm. Not to keep him busy on Shabbos afternoons, you know, that's what he wrote for him. But the point is, it's a major and classic source, and he goes through the mitzvahs. One of the unique things about this work is, not only does he give you the halachic parameters of each mitzvah, he also gives you what he calls taimei mishor she'a mitzvah. That means, he gives you what in English we would call the reason for the commandment. Now we don't ultimately mean a reason. We don't know the reasons for commandments. The ultimate reason is because he says so. But we have what's called a taim. That means an understanding at our level of why he would give us such a commandment. Okay? Yes? Now, let me share with you his insight into two mitzvahs in the Torah. And I'd like you to see that he gives a conflicting outcome from these two. And our work this afternoon will be to resolve that. Okay, a little Torah learning exercise together. Can we do that? Okay, I warn you, it needs concentration. I want to share with you two mitzvahs that he mentions. And out of these two mitzvahs, I'd like to extract our concept. In other words, is free will real, or is it only an action which does not have a genuine output? And I'll try to show you that in these two mitzvahs, he contradicts himself. And we know that's not possible. So our work will be to try to resolve the contradiction, and I believe in doing so, we'll come out clearly on one or other side of this debate. Okay, you game? Yep. Right, let's try. In the mitzvah, where he talks about the mitzvah of taking revenge, right? Taking revenge, I think it's in Resh Mem. Allah, if you want to look it up. He talks about the prohibition of taking revenge or bearing a grudge. You know, a Jew is not allowed to take revenge or bear a grudge. Okay? Torah prohibition. What's the definition of bearing a grudge and taking revenge? Like this. Let's say you go over to your neighbor and you say, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And your neighbor says no. Next week he comes over to you and says, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And you say no. That's called nekama, taking revenge. The definition is, you do to a person exactly what he did to you because he did that to you. Because he did it, you do exactly the same to him. Jews not allowed to do that. What's the definition of bearing a grudge? You go to your neighbor and say, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" He says no. Next week he comes over and says, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And you say, "Sure, I'm not like you." That is called bearing a grudge. Jews not allowed to do that. What do you have to do? Say nothing and give him the lawnmower. Okay? They tell a story about an individual who was crawling through the desert dying of thirst. As he was about to expire, another man rode past on horseback, looked down at him, saw him dying, left him to die and rode on. Miraculously he survived, and some years later it turned out to be the president of a large corporation, when one day his office door opened and a man came in asking for a job. And he recognized the face of the man who left him to die in the desert. If he would have refused to give him the job, he would have been taking revenge. If he would have given him a job and reminded him of what had happened, he would have been bearing a grudge. He said nothing and gave the man the job. That's what a Jew is required to do. Of course, if he's unsuitable for the job, for example, let's say he's applying for the job of taking tender, gentle care of frail, elderly individuals, yeah, then you might reason that he's unsuitable for the job. That's fine. That's not bearing a grudge or taking revenge. The man's just unsuitable. Is this clear? But to do to him what he did to you because he did it, that you're not allowed to do, or rub it in the sense of a grudge, you cannot do. So far, so good? Okay, every Jew has to know that. That's a clear, you have to be careful, by the way, when you punish children, they shouldn't get the message that it's a vengeful type of an act. Right? Children have to understand there's a difference between justice and nekama, which is a personal, vengeful grudge or revenge for a thing. You have to understand. Important distinction. Yeah? I said there's a big difference between revenge and justice. For example, he takes revenge in the sense of justice. Kael nekamos Hashem. God is a God of vengeance. Which means the form of punishment that people do wrong get exactly what they did because they did that wrong. That's called justice. That's not called revenge. You have to know, revenge is not because he deserves it in terms of justice, but because you can't stand what happened to you and you need to get back at him from a personal, small-minded motive. And that's bearing a grudge too. For example, if I say to you, "Why did you treat me like that?" And I upbraid you and I rebuke you. That's not bearing a grudge. That's correcting you. And I'm supposed to do that. But if I do it because I am small-minded enough to bear this as a personal issue, that's a completely different... That's a motivation and the tone of voice and the method with which it's applied, it can be critical. So, that's what he says in the mitzvah. Now, listen to the reason. Stay with me. It's fascinating. The reason is like this. When he gets to explain why you should not take revenge against people, he says this. When someone harms you, the Torah says don't take revenge. What's the Torah's reason? What do you got against him? You must have had it coming. Why do you want to take revenge? This person damaged your property, right? So now you've got this motivation, you hold it against him, you want to take revenge. Surely you know whatever you get in life is your own dispensation. You must have had it coming. And therefore there's no sense in taking revenge because it's philosophically mistaken. The damage didn't come from the individual. Can you see clearly on which side of the debate he appears to be coming down? Okay, now let's look at the conflicting source. This is a bit more complicated. There's a mitzvah in the Torah known as Hazama, right? Edim Zomimin. Let me explain very briefly what it is. A very perplexing and mysterious thing. In secular law, you do not have any concept like this. So explain it basically, without all the details. Edim Zomimin is the following situation. Let's assume you have a court case. And in this case, someone's accused of some crime, and two witnesses testify. Now, in Jewish law, in halakha, we accept the testimony of two witnesses, even to the point of a death sentence. Okay, that is the gold standard. two witnesses under the correct constraints and details that are required within the correct parameters. We accept the testimony of two witnesses, and that is the absolute form of a witness or testimony in Jewish law. What happens if two other witnesses come along and contradict the first two witnesses? So normally, if they simply contradict them, the case is hung. For example, A and B say that someone killed someone, and C and D come along and say you didn't. So you got what's called treu-treu, two against two, and what's the result of that court case? Dissolved. No case, right? Why? Because conflicting evidence, we don't know who's telling the truth. By the way, we assume in the future that all were telling the truth. That means neither pair of witnesses is invalidated in the future, because we don't have evidence that they were the liars. You hear this? You two come along in a court case and you testify. You two testify against them. We don't know which of you is lying. Tomorrow there's another case in which these two come. We accept their testimony, because we assume yesterday they were the ones telling the truth. The day after there's another case and these two come along, we accept their testimony. We assume then that they were telling the truth. Yes? Because you can't judge someone as guilty until proved guilty. There's one case we will not allow, by the way. Do you know what that is? If this witness and that witness come together in a subsequent case, then we won't allow. Because then we know for sure somebody's lying here. Yes? If one party of one of the pair, one pair, and one party of another pair come together as witnesses subsequently, we disallow that. Okay? These are some of the laws of contradictory evidence. But there's one remarkable case that has a different outcome. Now listen carefully. Let's say the first two witnesses come along, these two, and they say that someone owes someone money or someone killed someone else. And two subsequent witnesses come along and they do not contradict the testimony, but they say that the first two witnesses could not have seen it. They say, you could not have seen the crime because you were with us in some other time, and at that time, you were with us in some other place. Note that they do not contradict the testimony. They don't say whether the person did kill or didn't kill. They just say that you are not valid witnesses, you could not have been there. Contrary to what you might expect, the Torah says, we believe the second two. Okay, get this clear. Again, are we together? A and B come along and say, X killed. And they give all the required testimony. C and D come along and say, we don't know if he killed or not. We're not speaking to the case. But A and B could not have been there to see it, because they were with us in Tel Aviv on that day. Yes? And the murder, you say, took place in Jerusalem. Okay? Then says the Torah, although we don't know which are the lying pairs, says the Torah, you accept the second two? You believe the second two? For homework. Would you like some homework? For homework, think what could be the logic of believing the second two as opposed to the first two. Why? Homework. This is not our subject today, but why would we believe the second two? After all, maybe the first two are lying. Maybe the second two are lying. Torah says you believe the second two and you invalidate the first. But listen to this. You invalidate the first two witnesses and you punish him with whatever they would have wanted to do to the victim they were accusing. Okay, so let's say it's a capital case. A and B come along and say, X killed someone. He's on trial for his life now. C and D walk in and say, A and B are lying. They were not there. They were with us in some other place. We accept that testimony and A and B are put to death. Because they get what they wanted to do to the person they were accusing. If they accuse him of having a large sum of money that he has to pay, then they themselves have to pay that sum of money. Whatever they accuse the victim, yes, that would have happened had the case been carried through, execution began, they themselves get that punishment, because the Torah says so. So far clear? Now here comes one unusual, very unusual quirk of this case, which will take a little thought. Listen carefully. They only get the punishment that they wish to execute on the victim if it's not yet been carried out. But if it's been carried out, then they are exempt. Let me show you how strange this is. A and B come along and say, X killed. He's now on trial for his life. They judge the case, the Beis Din, and they adjudicate death and they're about to kill him. Just before they kill him, C and D run into court and say, A and B are lying, they weren't there. If the victim, the accused, has not yet been executed, we pull him off death row, right, and we save his life, and we kill the first two witnesses for what they attempted to do. But if he's already been executed and he's died, we close the case and everyone goes home and that get no punishment at all. Isn't that counter to what you might expect? You might expect that if they saved in the nick of time and his life is saved, then they don't get punished, right? No. In that circumstance, when his life is saved, they get punished. If he's been killed already, then we say, nothing doing, case closed, scot-free, no further consequence. Now obviously there needs explanation, and there are wonderful explanations, there are Kabbalistic explanations, one of the classics is written in the Maral, and I'll leave you to look it up for homework, because it's a fascinating exercise in the examination of a mitzvah. But the chinuch, the source we're studying today, offers a very interesting insight, and I hope you'll see that it contradicts the insight we had from the first case. He says this. He says, look, if the person died, listen carefully, okay, step by step, carefully. Let's get it right. A and B come into court and they testify that X killed someone. And C and D come along and say that they're lying, but he's already been killed. What do? We exempt them. Says the chinuch, you know why? If he got killed already, he must have had it coming. How could it have been the fault of A and B? They could never incriminate somebody and give him a punishment that he didn't necessarily deserve. So what do you want from them? They're irrelevant. So far, so good? But listen to his language. By the way, it doesn't mean that they adjudicated the case correctly. It just means he did deserve to die. Not necessarily for this reason. But it is justice, okay? If they said he had to pay money, they might make a mistake in this court case. They may be wrong about the case, but he owed money. You understand? He deserved to lose the money, and the other fellow deserved to get the money for unknown reasons to us. But there can be no miscarriage of justice. But listen to his words. He puts in one critical phrase. He says, you know why a Jewish court of law can never generate a miscarriage of justice? Because in every duly constituted based in, God himself is present. The phrase is Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Kael. The language he uses is Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Hadayonim. God himself, the word Elokim means God's manifestation of justice. Hashem himself sits together with every Jewish court of law. Okay? And therefore, duly constituted based in, not two lying judges. Remember we started with this case? Any duly constituted based in, three valid judges. Okay? No matter how intelligent or no matter how what, these three people, they adjudicate a case duly constituted, duly processed in Jewish law. God himself is part of that convocation, and therefore the result can never be wrong. The person can only get what he's deserved because there's a guarantee in the system, namely that Hashem sits together with the court of law. Now, if you have any Talmudic experience, any Jewish learning experience, you automatically make what we call a diuk. A diuk is an inference. And here's the inference. The chinuch says that no court case can ever go wrong because you could never impose on someone something that he doesn't deserve because human beings in a court can never do that because God sits with them. Implication is, if it were not a court, it could go wrong. After all, the only reason it couldn't go wrong is because in a court of law, Hashem is there, and therefore human beings could never impose on someone else something he doesn't deserve in those circumstances, because he says in those circumstances, and the reason is because Hashem himself is there, but there's no verse in the Torah that says that Hashem is with you when you pass judgment on somebody. When you act alone as an individual, you could certainly get it wrong. Do you see the implication? It's an inference. And these two inferences clash. Let me just finish the analysis. These two inferences clash. Here he says that you could only, yes, you only get what's guaranteed coming to you in the circumstances of a court of law based in. The clear implication is that an individual acting alone could certainly impose on something that which they don't deserve. So how could he say in the law of revenge that you should never hold it against someone else because you only got what was coming to you? But the resolution is like this. In the case of revenge, what he means is you only get what's coming to you in terms of your merits. That's what he means. How much schus you have in terms of your merit. When someone harms you, don't look to them as the cause of your harm. Ask yourself why you weren't spiritually better. That's what he means. Do you understand? Had you generated more merit, had you worked on yourself more, had you not regarded yourself as a biological material and as a vague accidental statistic in the world, had you generated spiritual content, had you merited more spiritual level, you would have been impervious to that damage. And therefore, although the person is accountable, and although he caused the damage, don't look to him. That's not the spiritual way to handle things. Look to yourself and ask yourself why you weren't on a higher level, and therefore don't hold it against him. And therefore the chinuch's opinion is clearly, in both these sources, if you analyze it carefully, that he takes the line of the famous Orach Chaim, as we said before, and that is that human free will is dangerous, is real. The message is, people are dangerous. People are dangerous. No snakes and scorpions are any more dangerous than your situation requires. Is this clear? That doesn't mean you put yourself into danger. That's problematic. That's morally problematic. And you can harm yourself that way. But no snake or scorpion, no loose brick in a building, no accidental runaway bus. Nothing like that can touch you, right? Because other than what you yourself need. But human beings, under certain circumstances, as we try to explain, are more dangerous than those things, because they can harm you to a greater level than your own circumstance, as it were, requires. Of course you can protect yourself. Of course, this is not a free-for-all, right? And in practice, as I said, it's extremely limited. But a Jew has to know, in the philosophical root of this issue, human beings have meaningful free will, not just choose to act, as it were, but genuinely affect an outcome in the world, and that is subject to the parameters that we discussed. Let me stop for questions in case this or related matters are not clear. Please.
Tell me, I'm sure that you have there's a thing of free will, because if you're wrong, you're and everything that happens in your life, whether it's sympathetic or selfish or tragic, is all the share. And it must be the case because we come from young people who are cancer, and people answer good little to hunger. It's all the share. I personally believe that there is
no such thing
as free will.
It's your thought. And if you have a good thought, let's try to analyze this slowly. The concept of Bashirt and that things happen for a reason and for a meaning is not a contradiction to free will. Again, a young person dying, a baby, Chas v'Shalom, dying, that sort of thing, got nothing to do with my free will. Free will means that a person over bar mitzvah can make meaningful choices in life. What we discussed this afternoon is that choice takes two possible philosophical forms. Either he chooses to act in a particular direction, the outcome is not up to him, but he's liable for his choice. And according to the second opinion, the outcome does depend on him in an absolute sense. But we certainly accept in Jewish philosophy, in Torah thinking, that the person is free. Certainly free. He could have chosen otherwise. He could have chosen the morally reprehensible course of action. And he was free to choose the moral one. You better believe that. Otherwise, there's no action in life possible at all. We might as well just do... If everything's bashirt, for example, let's take a classical example. Here's a classical application. A marriage partner is certainly bashirt. The things you talked about, whether children dying and that sort of thing, but a marriage partner is clearly written that it's bashirt. Before a child is born in the spiritual world, the word goes out, so-and-so is to marry so-and-so. What does bashirt mean? Does it mean a destiny in the English sense? That means that it's inevitable? Is that what it means, bashirt? If it does, what's the problem? Let's say a young person wants to get married. You want to get married. What's the problem? Walk out into the street, grab the first thing in a skirt that walks past. I mean, these days that's no guarantee, but I mean, grab something, something that's ostensibly appropriate, and get married. If it is bashirt, you must be right. That's not what bashirt means. Bashirt means there is an ideal partner set up spiritually. The Kabbalistic teaching is that you and she were one before being brought down to the world, torn apart in a deep Kabbalistic sense, and given the job to reunite at that one common soul. No guarantee you will do it. That potentiality is set up. It's up to your free will and the engaging and the work that you do together and so forth, whether you will actually actualize that. Bashir doesn't mean a destiny in the English sense that you can never get out of it. Secondly, free will only applies in the moral zone. You spoke about the happy events in life and tragedies. Free will only, you're quite right about those. Free will only applies in the moral battle about how you handle those situations. Free will's only in the zone of the spiritual side of conscience and elevation, fighting against the sensual and earthy and animal and bodily. That's the only place where free will applies. Nothing to do with how wealthy you'll be, for example. That's, you're quite right. That's, so to speak, bashir. On Rosh Hashanah, decided how much money you'll make in the year. You can damage yourself financially, but that's a moral issue. But you can never earn more than a certain amount. And you see it's not subject to free will. Some people are extremely intelligent, make all the right moves in business and are poverty stricken. Other people are complete idiots and are very wealthy. I happen to know a few who are. The issue is that there's not a direct relationship between free will, right? And therefore, whom you choose as a marriage partner. Even that's limited. A young man cannot experience a relationship with every woman on earth, even though many seem to be trying in this generation. But the point is that, there's a limitation as to the... Our notion of free will, it's only in how you handle the battles and the ordeals in the moral sense. And we have to discuss the basis of free will in more detail. Yes, please.
I just wondered, if that's the case, you are one person damaged by the application of free will, how does the judgment dynamic work? In other words, why is it that God will listen to him rather than who tries to be damaged to me, rather than to me on my own merits?
I'm not sure what your question is. Let's say you're sitting in a court of law. Let's just run it through. And the court hears the evidence on both sides and I make a judgment, okay?
Yes.
So if it's a duly constituted basin with valid judges, then the principle is Hashem sits with him. And whatever happens was due. Now, there may be a technical miscarriage of justice that loan never took place. But that person needed that money and that person needed to lose it in the absolute spiritual accounting. And you may rest assured that that's the case. And therefore, we have no second thoughts about a duly constituted, properly conducted dinto. Outside is dependent on our debate. If you take the first line and thinking you can never affect anyone else, but you're guilty for your action because Hashem puts you in the world to act morally, and if you don't, you're accountable. He would have got it anyway, but that's not your issue, and you're not his issue. According to the second line of thinking, if you're powerful enough, you can affect him. I spent an hour explaining that. That means human free will. Were you here at the beginning? Human free will is so important that the whole thing is reconfigured to allow him to suffer that destiny because your free will is real in the world. You are dangerous. Yeah. Yes, please.
Can you explain the suicide bombers?
What do I need to explain? Of course, when a person does an immoral action and kills many people, what's the problem? They're using their free will. You know what's fascinating, though, is what about the victims? The Talmud says this. Now, this is another whole discussion, and I can't get into it now. It relates to things like the Holocaust. But I'll just mention this. When a group of victims suffer together, the Talmud says there are two basic possibilities. One is they all needed that particular event, so they were invited to be at the same place and time. The Talmudic language is, Mazminam lepundak echad. They're all invited into one shack. Yes, that means, let's say a ship sinks with many people on board. There are two possibilities. Those people might all be people whose lives were meant to end at that moment. So they're all led to buy tickets on the same ship. You don't put that past the divine computer, do you? Again, let's get this right. There are a number of people, yes, of the millions of people whose destinies are to die at a particular time. How's that accomplished? Either they die individually where they are, or for certain reasons, it could be they all buy a ticket on the same ship, which then goes down. That's one possibility. The second possibility, says the Gemara, which is much more problematic to understand, is that some of them, or one of them, needed to die, and the others happened to be in the wrong time and place. The language that's used is Oy l'rosh oy l'shchenoy. That means if it's bad for an individual, it may be bad for his neighbors. You're affected because you're a neighbor, not because you deserved it. And the most extreme version of that, extreme version, in Holocaust-type situations, la'alenu, is, the Gemara says like this, Kevan shenitan reshus lemashchis lashchis, when permission is given to the destroyer to run amok and destroy, shuv enoy mafin, he no longer discerns between deserving and undeserving. Which means when you have a mass destruction, right, things work in such a way that those who deserve and those who don't deserve are not discerned. And that, of course, is a philosophical problem. How is justice for each individual? And that needs its own discussion. Why do we make a distinction technically between a group of people who are all dying because they all needed to be there and then, or a group of people... Can I challenge you with an exercise? What difference does it make if a ship is sinking and everyone was meant to be there at that time, was invited there, or philosophically only certain that we're meant to be there, doesn't just happen to be there? What difference does it make? It makes a very big difference. In the first case, there's no use escaping. You will not escape. You're there because you bought a ticket there because you're meant to be there. In the second case, get out. You're only there because the other people are going through that thing. Get out of there. Yeah? And of course, since we're in doubt, we make every attempt to escape and to save everybody that we can. But those are the two possibilities. This is a difficult discussion, needs its own full analysis. Why is there no discerning between righteous and non-righteous? This needs a full analysis. Yes?
I was only going to say that those people who have got reservations then, and going to visit Israel during times of trouble because they're scared.
Right.
What happens there?
Good question. Here's a complicated question. What about people who would like to visit Israel, and it's a troubled time, perhaps a dangerous time? It's a very complicated question. I'll tell you why. First of all, there are many layers to your question which make it extremely, let alone the political levels, yes? But the halachic levels are like this. First of all, to visit Israel in a time of trouble may be a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to visit anyway. Now, when you perform a mitzvah sincerely, you are protected against danger. Factor number one. Okay, shluchei mitzvah. Not only there, but on your way back too. Number two is, on the other hand, you're not allowed to put yourself into a situation of explicit danger, then you're not protected. Then the question becomes, how explicit is the danger? Yeah, it's not clear that being in Israel in a time like this is highly dangerous. Far from it. Far from it. There are places where driving on the roads may be more dangerous than... that's not so clear. I mean, when we say heightened danger, we mean a more dramatic sort of situation. It doesn't mean that there's a mass danger. That's another issue. So there's very complicated factors that go into this, right? The basic bottom line is, you want to visit Israel today, it's fine. Fine. You're a lot safer there at present than you are here, I'm afraid. Yes? A friend of mine, a couple of months ago, son was due to go back to yeshiva in Israel. So he phoned his Rebbe, who lives in Israel, to ask him, is it acceptable? Some members of the family were a little anxious. The answer he was given was like this: it's more dangerous where you are in London than it is here. The next day he was attacked by four, I don't want to make any political statements, four individuals from the, who represent the different faith and political part of the spectrum on the street in Kensington. His jaw was broken, very seriously injured. It was a Palestinian demonstration nearby, and he was not so clear where you are in greater danger. That's a complicated question. Yeah, anything that I can answer? Yes. Right.
Everybody's life and eventuality.
Right.
And in that sense, if you look at time as a line,
right,
then the end result is no.
Right. I'm with you. I understand your question. The question here is, from a divine perspective, it's all known from the beginning anyway. This raises the conflict of divine foreknowledge and our free will, which is another talk. You'll have to invite me again. Okay? And that, you're right, is a conflict. We're not talking about that today. Today we do not speak about divine foreknowledge, which is completely above this discussion. We're talking about, as it were, a destiny or a decree. Not his foreknowledge. He knows, yeah, according to both opinions, he knows what's going to happen. He either knows that your free will is only your choice and the person was going to die. And according to the second opinion, he knows that the person didn't deserve to die, was going to die anyway today. That's completely above the level of this discussion. And you're right, it's a genuine problem. It's one of the deepest, touches on the deepest philosophical issues and problems in Jewish, in spiritual thinking altogether. But I'm not going to go into that now. Yes, please. The question is, what's the point of praying when whatever happens is for the best anyway, or we believe that? We don't believe it. We believe that your prayer is necessary, and it will be worse without it and better with it. He listens and it makes a difference. You better believe it. What's the sense of pouring your heart out in requests? Most of our prayers are actually requests. Wouldn't make any sense if it's not going to make any difference. How to work that out philosophically is another whole talk, and you'll have to invite me again. But I have a tape on that which you're welcome to pick up. There's CDs and tapes here someplace where the problem, exactly this problem, there are many other problems incidentally. Not only how do you change his mind? How do you change his mind? If he's going to do for you what you need, and surely he is, then how do you change his mind by making a good presentation? You know, that's miraculous. What does that mean? It's all part of the same large question. Bottom line, prayer's a mitzvah. Tefillah is a mitzvah, and it certainly makes a difference. He waits for you, and he answers. It means he deals with you according to what you genuinely want, according to the level that you clarify as you. The level of meditation, the level of clarity, of ego negation that you've reached, right, is a genuine factor in what happens to you. The key, if you like, is how sincerely are you asking for you, and how sincerely are you asking for these things you need for him. To the extent that you're asking them for you, that's a chutzpah. To the extent that you're asking for these things like health for you because you want to serve him, that's a big spiritual work. And to the extent that you achieve that spiritual work, you get given it because you could use it. Okay, needs more, but that's a general approach. Yes, please. Last question.
You said that that my free will can affect someone else.
According to one opinion. Yeah.
Right. Does that include my merits or his merits?
Your free will is up to your choice.
Clear cut.
Your free will means your choice. How you make your choices and how free you genuinely are within yourself is another discussion.
Yeah, but whether I can do it depends on my merit.
Whether you can harm him or not?
Yeah.
No.
I can do my own thing because of what I've done, whether I can do it to him because of
what I understand what you mean. That depends on your spiritual level. to the extent that you are a real human being, you're a Baal Bechira, you're somebody who's lifted himself to genuine spiritual content, you have an effect in the world. To the extent that you walk around as a piece of accidental, statistical nothing, yes, you get judged that way, you get handled that way, and you have that little free will. Yes? Person who walks around thinking that he's a statistic, he's a piece of a biological creature like the animals, that's not how the person has achieved the level of meaningful free will. Yeah? The source I pointed out, we learn, is the brothers, Joseph and his brothers. He's talking about people who are cosmic in their greatness. To that extent, you can manipulate the history of the world. To that extent. But don't forget, even if you don't, you're accounted as if you did. Even according to the second opinion, you're accountable for your choices. The fact that the victim would have suffered anyway is not your issue. Okay, let me thank you for listening and...